Hi, myself for coming to today's session. I'm Henry. So today's inside session is organized by the Wealth Management Subcommittee. So our committee has a particular focus on investment management side. Our goal is to organize one of those investment-related inside session every quarter. So after the session, if you got any feedback, thought on how we can improve this target, these activities, or even if you're interested to join our committees, feel free to send me an email. My email is up there, we can talk further. So firstly, it's absolutely my pleasure to have Wei Li today. He's a head of Quant Investing and director of research for Newburgh Development in New York. He has won the head of Quant Head for quite a while. So before he joined Newburgh in 2014, he was head of Quant at Credit Suisse. And before that, he was head of Quant research at JP Morgan. So from 1994 to 1996, he was a postdoctoral research fellow at the Harvard Graduate School of Business, and he holds an MBA and PhD degree in finance from Drexel University. Also, we had a book. He's the author of the book Theory and the Methodology of Tactical Asset Allocation, which I quite enjoyed because I was learning at tactical asset allocation in my fund. He has also served on the advisory board of the Journal of Portfolio Management. His research work has appeared in many academic-related journals and industrial journals, and has won a fair bit of prestigious awards, including 2012 Peter L. Bernstein Award, Best Article of the Year 2012, Outstanding Article of the Year 2012 from Journal of Portfolio Management. So the bio and the achievement of why is quite long. He sent me a 20-page long series I managed to cut into three paragraphs. So I'm not going to go through all his achievements, but I think by the introduction so far, what we see is why my shares are similar characteristics of actuaries, when we all have very strong quantitative backgrounds. We have been through quite extensive education on the mathematics and statistics. So I think it's really lucky that we have Y from US to give us a presentation today on his research work on the risk premium, and perhaps also share some of his experience as a quant, as a very successful nerd in the industry. So without any further ado, please welcome Y.
So good afternoon, and the pleasure is mine. As a matter of fact, after I learned about what your institute is about, I told my colleagues, I don't even dare to take CFA level 1 in US and not to go through what you have gone through. So the pleasure and honor is mine to be invited to be here to speak to you. And please call me Y, that's the name that I go by. And just to give you a bit more background about myself, and hopefully you can connect more the content with the person standing in front of you in a few minutes. So I did have a technical background. In fact, I grew up in Hong Kong, and I finished my undergrad degree in mechanical engineering in Hong Kong. But I was an engineer only for 1 year. Then I moved to the States and did my MBA. And in fact, when I was in the MBA program, I wanted to be major in marketing. So I was thinking, how do I use my background in engineering, my marketing? But then after I took the first finance course and first economics course, I thought it was easy. Because like in microeconomics, we were taught like the marginal cost equal to marginal revenue. Like you just take first derivative. It's simple math, right? It's high school math. So I thought economics was easy. And then I was lucky to be offered a research assistantship by the school. And they waived me for the tuition and gave me a fellowship for 2 years. So I finished MBA and somehow I switched to finance because I thought it was easy, learning like IRR, internal rate of return, or payback period in capital budgeting, right? You count how many years of payback. Oh, that was night and day comparing to engineering and your discipline. But then at the time, it was 1990 when I was looking for a job, and we got hit by the recession. And the job market was very difficult. But in fact, before that, I was getting more and more interested in pursuing research. And the school talked to me and said, well, would you be interested to do a PhD? I said, okay, why not? So I didn't really plan on my career. And then I became like in a PhD program of finance. And then 1994, when I was trying to look for a job to teach as a professor, then I got a fax from Harvard Business School when they were looking for postdoc. And I thought, well, it was Harvard, right? And then the position was very interesting because they gave you stipends as a junior faculty member and also the opportunity to take courses at Harvard and work with the professor. So that's how I went there. And I think that 2 years really changed my career path completely because I had the opportunity to work with the professor, Andre Perrault, who has retired from Harvard a few years ago, but he's running his own firm called a high-vis turnout in Boston. And I think from Professor Perrault, I learned about sometimes that you could really use your elegant research, not for the sake of being elegant, but in fact, there are many opportunities to apply academic research in the industry. And I was very, very impressed by his work that he did with a number of other financial firms in the industry. And eventually, I had the opportunity to join J.P. Morgan Investment Management. And that was my first employer, and J.P. Morgan is a fundamental shop. So I actually had applied to quant shops, but nobody took me. It turned out the fundamental shop took me in to become their first quants to work on asset allocation, and that's how I started my career. And I think it was a very interesting experience as a quant to be in a fundamental shop. And I felt like from time to time, I think there is a more higher degree of interest from me to learn more about what they do than the other way around. Because whenever I remember one of the first lunch I had with my boss, the global head of asset allocation, when I kept talking to him about Farmer French as if I thought everyone knew Farmer French, it turns out after the lunch he asked me, so who the heck was Farmer? Okay. Anyway, I thought after those 4 years, I became more and more interested in finding opportunities to apply what we learn in school into our discipline, investment management. So as Henry has known me for a while already, and he has seen my presentation a couple times, I take pretty high risk in doing my presentation because sometimes you take the risk of turning off your audience by quoting too much theory. Okay, but I still thought it's very important to go back to the drawing board and see if you can relate what we observe every day in our industry to the theory. And there are other approaches, of course, right? But my personal passion is really whenever I feel like the data or the news or be it noise or real news sometimes remind me, in fact, there are some natural laws in the industry that remind me of what I learned from school, I got excited. And that's one of the reasons that pushed me to just keep continue to do my job. And now it's more than 20 years and still going on. Still, I expect to be around, hopefully. So anyway, this topic about risk premium is one of the, to me, is one of the most exciting topics because it has a very strong foundation in asset pricing theory, as a matter of fact. Now, and believe me, I can totally skip the asset pricing theory part and still do the same presentation as more like commercial driven, right? To be honest, we do have a commercial interest because we do manage risk premium for our clients as a part of the solution to their investment problems. But whenever I can help my clients and audience to relate what we are doing every day, again, back to the theory, I think it gives us a higher degree of comfort what we are doing makes sense. And when it makes sense, you have a higher degree of confidence as well that it can persist going forward. So without further delay, I am just going to just explain to you what I mean by the title and the Big Bang, right? I don't have to explain to you what is the Big Bang. It's not that I know better than anyone does, but it really represents the beginning as well as expansion. So to me, it represents at least two things, the start and it is expanding, right? At least that's what the theory tells us, the universe is expanding. Risk premium, in a few slides, I will try to just define it briefly so that we speak the same language. It might have become a buzzword, like factor investing, risk premium investing, and the like. But we do have some more like tangible words to describe what makes something a risk premium. So let me just start by spending hopefully less than 5 minutes on this slide. This slide, in fact, has a lot of asset pricing theory behind it. What I'm trying to achieve in here is to, in 5 minutes, give you the context of how do we relate what we call risk premium today back to more than 60 years ago, when the economists were trying to, at the time, conceptualize asset pricing. But they had not figured out how to implement it yet. In some of the more detailed presentations I gave before, I went through more details in here. But suffice to say, in more like to me, it started in 1950s, when economists were trying to find out like how do we quantify the payoff of an investable vehicle. And there were a theory that came about called like stage contingent claim analysis, and eventually the security was named after two economists, Arrow and DeBru. And the origin of this risk premium is really risk. Okay. And fast forward to more like today, when you might have talked to some of my peers or asset managers and investors as well. Many of us like to think of the world as if there were only four scenarios. Right, we like to think along two dimensions. One is growth and one is inflation. And then as if there were only four possibilities, when each of the two dimensions is accelerating, decelerating, and you get the point with two dimensions, you get up to four scenarios. And as if we knew exactly in which quadrant, like when growth and inflation are both accelerating, then we know exactly how stocks is going to do. So next month, yesterday you got a cut 25 basis points, suppose hypothetically you get an inflationary shock next month, do we really know exactly how stocks and Aussie bonds will do? Somewhat, but not exactly. We don't know how to quantify it. So that has a lot to do with in the 1950s when the economists tried to conceptualize this and define something called a state. But, you know, what is a state? How many states? We don't know. We didn't know. So then if you look at my second column, this works. I put down the timeline in here in the 60s. When I first joined the industry in the 90s, I was a little bit irritated because my colleagues, when they talk about CAPM, they usually focus on where it went wrong and make fun of it. And fresh out coming from school, I thought I was offended because I spent so many years learning something that they were making fun of in the industry. Now, only after many years later, I started to appreciate CAPM. It really marked the starting point that we can implement asset pricing theory. And there are something in between as well. Let me just skip the details, like the fund separation theorem, for example. But if you think about the capital asset pricing model in the 60s, it let us bypass the step of defining a state. Now, if you just strictly apply CAPM, right, you don't care what is growth and inflation, because the theory told us the only risk premium you need to care is the market risk premium. That's it, right? The only portfolio of risky assets you care about is the market portfolio. Now, you don't have to follow it, but at least it forms the foundation. It anchors. It is an anchor of everything else we do. So for the first time, when we implement asset pricing theory, we know, okay, let's launch index fund. That's what we saw in the 70s. In early 70s, Wells Fargo launched the first equal-weighted index fund by Bill Fowles, and then eventually he learned that like equal-weighting, you know, we are talking about more than 40 years ago, transaction cost was much higher at the time. He found that equal-weight didn't really work in practice. Not until Vanguard came into the picture at the right time with the right outfit and the right institutional setup, we took index funds to the roof. And now Vanguard was huge, right? And that's really from CAPM, and that's the way the industry responded to the asset pricing theory. Then we started to have these like bond index and other asset class as well, and they are all within what we call the traditional risk premium camp. Traditional means they are all long only. They all go by asset classes. But again, behind stocks index funds, bond index funds, we don't really know exactly how each one of them will respond in inflationary environment, deflationary environment, But somehow you know that through these essay classes, you have exposure to these more fundamental factors. Now, then I also put down another little bullet point in there, risk parity. Okay. So what is risk parity? Another topic that was very, very popular like five years ago around, and that was like post-financial crisis. Like basically risk parity is a strategy that told us, well, if you look at traditional portfolio 60-40, most of the risk was coming from equity. And one way to balance it is, well, you have to leverage fixed income, and you know, whether you believe it or not, it gave you more diversification. So risk parity indeed was a very hot topic a few years ago, and there were significant inflows to it. And now my story of why in the last 3 years we had more and more explosive interest in this alternative risk premium is when you look at the history of how the industry respond to development of asset pricing theory. 70s, we had index funds, and 80s, 90s, what happened? In the 80s and 90s, we started to have hedge funds, and once upon a time, we considered hedge funds as a new asset class. Until later, we found out, in fact, the most distinguishing feature of hedge fund is regulation, right? They don't create new asset classes, they just invest in a much less restrictive way. And then we have private equity and all the other private debt infrastructure investing. And in a few minutes, I'm going to show you a slide, one example, how we can proxy private equity by tradable securities in the liquid market as well. So I think my story was for a period of time, we thought we could diversify our investing by these new asset classes, like private equity and hedge funds. Until in the last few years, many of us started to recognize, in fact, private equity could be closely proxied by liquid risk premium as well. So how do you get diversification? I think my sense is many of my clients started to feel like they have exhausted diversification opportunities. And now they started to go by the alternative risk premium. So what are these alternative risk premium? What are they really? Is I use a pie chart in here to show you some of the development in the academic literature, such as in the equity side. If you look at this big slide of the global portfolio in equities, early 90s, we started to see this pharma French model. And what they did was within a subset of the universe of assets called equities, US equities in particular, they found that beyond the beta, the cap and beta, there were other dimensions that help explain the cross-sectional dispersion of stock returns, individual names. And they named these as like the value factor, right? The book to price, the size, the size factor. And then subsequent research, I found momentum in the last 10 years. You heard more about quality, and then last 5-7 years, low beta, low volatility, etc. And actually, some other articles have documented that there are more than 300 factors published within the space of the equities. But if you look at equity as an example, essentially these factors or characteristics make up the gap. These are what we call more or less today the alternative risk premium. And likewise, in fixed income, you have other factors like carry, low risk, momentum, curve, etc. And I'm going to skip some of the other asset classes. So pretty much in this slide, in 5 minutes, I kind of try to pin down where did this alternative risk premium come about in terms of the evolution of asset pricing theory to today, and why the industry is now, you are hearing more and more asset managers getting into this space now. In the next slide that I am going to show you, this is what I call the most expensive page. I use lots of ink in my own printer in there. Now, this is another way of visualizing what is alternative risk premium. And now, let me start by have a little bit brief definition of what is a risk premium. Now, all of us are familiar with it, as a matter of fact, because equity, just stock, when you invest in ASX 200, MSCI world, it is what we call the stock risk premium, bond risk premium. These are more or less what we call the traditional, right? This is still the cap M type of regime. If you focus on individual asset class, each asset class is a risk premium. It's long only, traditional. And I represent it with a Rubik cube, but a very tidy, and I have never been able to turn it back. I still fail. I just don't know how to do it. I can do at most one phase, and you can get more or less my level. But if you look at this cube, essentially each color represents an asset class. And of course, I understand there are six phases, but I only show three in here. The three asset classes that we are more familiar with, right? Let's say yellow is stocks, red is real, and the blue is bond. This is more or less the 60-40 mentality, and this is also the more or less the risk parity mentality, because what risk parity does is you understand that, in fact, even though the area of the blue, the bond, is the same as stocks, but the risk coming from bonds is much lower than the risk coming from stocks. In order to balance the risk, you basically enlarge and amplify the blue surface and make it equal risk contribution with stocks. That's risk parity. The diversification within the traditional risk premium really came from leverage, risk balancing. Now, what about the I almost skipped the definition in here. Now, we make the examples of traditional risk premium, but what is a risk premium? Now, let's focus on these four keywords. One is it has to be systematic. It's rule-based, right? Equity investing, right? You invest in equity, that's a rule. It must have economic meaning that can provide reward in the long term. So equity risk premium, duration risk premium, and the other risk premium, like value momentum, to be discussed, whether they will provide reward going forward or not is a question. It has to be volatile. Okay, and there are some studies which try to compare how do you judge if a factor is volatile enough or not is you randomly select long-short securities portfolio by random, and then you look at the average volatility of these long-short random securities portfolio. That gives you a sense of what volatility of noise is about. That forms the anchor, and your factor, if it is really meaningful, it has to be at least more volatile than noise. So that's more like the empirical aspect. The last keywords or phrase, very, very important, is a risk premium must drive correlations. Now, what does that mean? If you go back to equity risk premium, again, the cap and the beta, right? So by ranking of the stocks by beta, you more or less can cluster them into certain type of behavior. High beta stocks means they are more volatile because they are all exposed to the same underlying factor called equity. If you have a factor that drives correlations of only two stocks, for example, then do we still call it a factor or not, right? I think in that case, clearly it's not, because it can only explain the return dispersion of two stocks. It is more what we call idiosyncratic. So if you go with this continuum in the literature, when you see a paper published and someone found a factor, they usually focus on the whole universe of securities. The factor has to explain the exposures of these stocks with respect to that factor, and the correlations mean something as well as it provides a reward. So there is some kind of soft requirements that for a factor to be a real factor, a real risk premium, it has to explain cross-sectional dispersion of the whole universe if it is only within an asset class. So all of these have to be considered together in order to define something as a risk premium. Now, what about alternative? Alternative risk premium, and you know, I had some meetings this morning, and I was told by some of my audience that some peers disagree with my view. As a matter of fact, like how I see alternative risk premium, in fact, my view is no one has created anything new. Because what is alternative risk premium? If you look at value premium, what does that mean? All right, the standard pharma friends told us you rank the stocks by book to price. You buy more of those top rank, and you sell or short or own less of what they call growth stocks, those rank at the bottom. They don't create anything new, right? It's just overweighting, underweighting, long and short. So the way I would represent them in a hopefully visually stimulating is you take the original space, the cube, you rotate it. Now, if you look at the yellow, the top two, suppose you are thinking about value premium, right? Essentially, these two stocks are the top rank book to price stocks. Some of them actually got to the bottom. Bottom means you short them or underweight them. So by rotating in a way that you prefer, supposedly it solves your investment problem, you create these alternative risk premium. Okay? And that's how I would characterize them. Nothing new has been created, but instead is you take advantage of the existing universe of assets, and to your satisfaction and requirement, you transform them into a different form. And down here, I put down some examples like value, momentum, carry, quality, and others. And again, there are more than 300 factors published that we can come back and address. Like, is it really possible that there are 300 factors? And please, by the way, please feel free to stop me if you have a view or a question for clarification. Okay, so the next one, the expansion. Well, what about the expansion? 300 factors published in the universe of securities. And I think, like, we are, given our background, you know, we are pretty technical, right? Take my challenge. If you take a universe of ASX 200, right? Well, you know, that may not be a good example because it's very concentrated. Take Russell 1000. Take Russell 1000. Run a principal component analysis. How many principal components do we think exist in 1000 names to take care of most of the cross-sectional dispersion of returns? I don't know the exact number, maybe 15, maybe 20, but it cannot be 300. So the fact that there are 300 factors published, it must be true that some of them are overlapped. There could be many of them that are redundant, right? So we talk about data mining, we talk about like economic meaning, etc. And in here, I think I put down one example is, now this is not to take me in the wrong direction. I'm not saying private equity has no value, okay? But instead, according to this paper, which is published in Journal of Finance, December 2012, the authors collected 4,500 individual private equity investment items, about half of them in US, the other half non-US, and they ran very simple, what you may call a style analysis, is to analyze the historical returns of this collection of private equity. It turns out that you could have proxied this private equity space with an R-square adjusted for degree of freedom of almost 87%. And what is this proxy? Well, it made up of about 0.6 units of illiquidity factor, which is published in another article by Pastor and Stambaugh, 2003. And this is built by individual stocks, tradable securities, plus 1.3 units of the market premium leverage, right? 1.3 units leverage. About 1 unit of farmer friend value factor, high minus low. And negligible exposure to small cap, as a matter of fact, is minus 0.4. Now, another number of interest is the intercept term. This is what the style analysis called style or risk-adjusted alpha. It turns out that this collection of private equity had no alpha beyond the exposures to illiquidity premium, size premium, a market premium and value premium. So this is to say you could have proxy private equity by exposing to 3 existing risk premium. Now, where, of course, it is not to say private equity has no value, because if you hire the manager to have access to the idiosyncratics, that's where the value add is. If you don't do the manager selection and just hire all of them, essentially, you are basically going back down to the existing risk premium. So, by definition, this collection of private equity is not a new risk premium, just as an example. Okay. Now, let me show you one example of the more well-known risk premium. And I have multiple goals by using this slide. Is to one extent is to explain to you what we mean by risk. To another is just to take a look of what happened after the financial crisis. Now, the red line in here is the year-on-year rolling 12 months return of the high minus low factor from Ken French website. Okay, and this is US, right, based on US data. The blue lines, I didn't do very well with Excel charts. But what I meant to show is in between a pair of blue lines is the NBER recessions. So if you look at the top charts first, there are 2 patterns that can be identified in here. The first one is, well, let me give you the answer, right? In between any 2 recessions, when you look at the business cycle, the first half of the cycle, like in here, you tend to see the value premium stronger than the second half of the cycle. Now, the late 90s was an exception because of the growth bubble. That value premium really got pounded down very big, and then it had the strongest rebound in history as well, right? But essentially, in every business cycle, you see more or less the same pattern. First half, strong value premium. Second half, much weaker. And second observation is, in fact, it was based on another article published 15 years ago. 2 professors from Columbia Business School, they used the value premium and the size premium to predict future GDP growth in multiple economies, and they found that in fact value premium and size premium could be used as leading indicator to GDP growth. So that is the way that they try to relate. In fact, what we observe in value premium could have been indeed a risk premium because it gave you the exposure to business cycles. So if you look at some of these rebound of the value premium, right, in here and 2009, and look at the most recent. In the last 6 months, the high minus low factor rebounded. Okay. Now, if you look at the news just a few days ago, the GDP first quarter of US, 0.5%. So somehow, the value premium rebound was might be premature if you just look at very short-term period. The securities market was telling us that the market, investors as an aggregate, was expected that economic growth will rebound in the US, but you know, we were wrong for the first quarter. Now, the first message in here is really, if you are able to see this pattern, it basically reflects, again, the paper published 15 years ago. It has a close association to the economic cycle. And down below gives you, hopefully, an even clearer picture. The blue line in here is the year-on-year industrial production growth, but 12 months forward. That's why the blue line ended 12 months before. Now, then you see this peak and trough, right? And I'm, you know, I don't have to teach you the data mine, but you can identify these patterns. Value premium, indeed, had exposures to economic growth. Now, that is a certain degree of comfort to me as a risk premium investor. If indeed the value premium is a risk premium, then I don't have to worry about the question about will it be arbitraged away. And as a matter of fact, if it is a risk premium, the word arbitrage is even wrong. It is a wrong word. You cannot arbitrage away risk. You can only diversify, you can only choose to not expose to it, but you cannot get it away. So much like when you question about the equity risk premium, you cannot arbitrage away the equity risk premium neither. Okay. So this is just another example is how do we evaluate if a risk premium is indeed related, well, if a factor is indeed related to risk or not. One way of looking at it is to relate it to identifiable economic cycle or some other risk elements. Okay. Now the last message I want to just share with you is my personal observation. And, you know, for those of us who follow the risk premium investing, you might have heard the value premium disappointed in the last 10 years. And indeed, you look at this red line in the last 10 years, it was essentially slightly negative on the average. The pattern is still there, okay? First half, whenever you have economic growth rebound, you see the value premium also rebounded. But I interpreted the fact that the red line is more or less below zero on the average after the post-financial crisis. Global financial crisis, essentially, it was telling me that all these years, in fact, when we traded the value premium, we had some reservation. We kept questioning if the economic rebound was real and persistent or not. Okay, that's one interpretation, that structurally the value premium is a bit lower than before. Of course, the counter argument is, well, maybe it gets crowded away. And we will try to come back to this question, is it really being crowded away? Or is it really being the securities market has been telling us we always have reservations about economic growth after the financial crisis? One more slide and then we will switch to a related topic in a couple minutes, which is on the discussion of crowding. How do we think about whether these will be crowded away or not? Now, this is the slide that I try to make a comparison between another buzzword or a very hot topic called smart beta. Okay, I suppose, right? Everyone has heard of smart beta, a big topic. And one of the smart beta providers, a few years ago, that was the last time I went to their seminar presentation, and they were very kind, they always invested me to join their seminar. And it was 3 years ago, they presented to the audience that they have created a menu of 2,700 scientific betas. So I was shocked, because if I look at the universe of assets, why do we need factor models? Is we try to impose a structure, right? If you think about equities, we have these risk models like Barra, Axioma, APT, etc. Is to use a structure in order to simplify the degree of freedom of dealing with 3,000 names, get down to a set of maybe 50 factors, maybe 60 factors, depends on which risk model you use. So instead of picking stocks, you try to look through the lens of factors, and then you go around the factors to look at the idiosyncratic component. That helped us to solve the investment problem. But now when you expand it to 2,700 betas, then essentially we go back to the square one. Now you have to spend your time to pick betas. Okay, so this is the one slide that I try to make a comparison of what do we mean by a risk premium versus a smart beta in terms of the outfit and the form, what goes beneath it. Now, for the time being, because for interest of time, I'm going to skip the left-hand side. It is the same set of data, but showed it in a different dimension. Just look at the right-hand side. And this is a hypothetical long-short portfolio behind a risk premium that I built. And in here, I use the Russell 1000 universe as my tradable vehicle. So there are 1,000 bars in here. And I line them up in descending order of the market cap. So the first bar in here represent, let's say, is positive, I cannot see the number, but you know, let's say positive 2%. So that means I'm going to buy the bigger stocks 2%, and the next one is short 1%, I'm going to short the next bigger stock by 1% and the like. So it's ordered by market cap. And clearly, you see this is a long short portfolio, right? You long some, you short some. And besides, you do not see a bias against or in favor of large cap or small cap. They are roughly about equal. And this is not by intention, but it just happened that this particular risk premium has almost like unbiased exposures to size premium. Okay? So if I was hired to do a risk premium investing, I would have traded these long and short position. Let's say 500 long, 500 short. Now suppose my same investors came to me and said, well, I cannot go short. Can you run the same risk premium investing but in a long only vehicle for me? Alright, then my next question will be, at what tracking error would you like me to run? How different do you want your portfolio, long only portfolio, how different should it be from the cap rate index? And okay, suppose I got three hypothetical answers. This is a 2% tracking error, low risk. The middle one is 5% tracking error, and the last one is a very high tracking error, 8%. And then I go back to the drawing board and use optimizers to optimize, to transform a long short risk premium now to a long only 2% tracking error, 5% tracking error, and 8% tracking error. Now, had I not explained to you the transformation, and I only show you the top chart, the long short risk premium, and the bottom chart, long only, would you have even associated this with that? The bottom chart actually is the derivative of the first chart. It's exactly the same risk premium. But the fact that my clients restrict me from shorting force me to go underweight the large cap. Okay. So this is really by construction. There's no way around it because you do not have that many ways to go underweight with the small names. So I just want to point it out to, for those investors who came to me and asked to see both versions, look at these and make a comparison, and you know, whichever way you feel comfortable, I can do it. Okay. So risk premium, when we package them together, we are going to trade this. Okay, but we also have long only versions that invest in something like this. Now, so now switch to a second topic, which is make out the next 15 minutes of it, is how do we think about if we will get paid by these alternative risk premium going forward. Now, when we invest in traditional premium, we don't normally question about, am I going to get paid by equity in the long term? We somewhat accept that there is an equity risk premium. It persists, right? But what about these alternative risk premium? And one of the big questions that I was often asked to address is crowding or arbitrage it away. So in the next 10 slides, I'm going to just give some thoughts on how do I think about it. Now, there have been many measures proposed in order to measure crowding. And I'm not going to go through any one of these measures, but instead I go by more conceptual. And let's think about it. So first of all is how do we think about why these risk premium existed? And I think someone tried to give it a pop quiz, and my three answers were taken away, hidden. So maybe you should give me the answer then. So to begin, why do these risk premiums exist? There were three schools of thought, and they are not necessarily mutually exclusive. And the first school of thought hidden in here is behavioral. Okay, it's behavioral. And the second school of thought is compensation to risk, which is what we call the school of risk. And the third bullet point in here should have been structural impediments. That's for some reason, some investors are restricted to have access to some risk premium, and they just don't have the opportunity. Oh, see, I'm the old school. I don't know how to build PowerPoint. And thank you. So, all right. So I flip forward. The three of them. behavioral compensation of risk and structural impediment. Now, the last one is more like unique. It's like scenario-based. I'm going to skip it. The first one, behavioral, I will only have one slide. And most of my other slides going forward will be focusing on compensation of risk, and I will not deny that I have a personal bias because of my own background. I wish what we have observed in the past is the result of compensation of risk, although it can coexist with behavioral explanations. Okay, so let me just go through the first slide, behavioral. And, you know, you have heard some of these stories like growth stock, value stock, elevator compensation, that we normally like to talk about things that sound exciting, growth stocks, right? And they catch your attention, you overbid the price, and therefore there is a value premium. Now, with all the respect, I think behavioral finance can explain almost everything, because we normally observe a behavior and then go back to the drawing board and derive a theory to explain that behavior. And to take it to the next level, the theory would be much more powerful, like prospect theory, if the same theory can explain what we observe and also be more comprehensive to project and predict the other behavior. So they will not fail. I mean, behavioral science can explain a lot of what we observe in there. Okay, so I'm going to skip the details. I'm not an expert at all. But instead, I found these two examples very interesting. They are not exactly related, especially the first one. There was an article published in Journal of Finance in 2003. What they found was unbelievable. They went all the way to find out the history of every day, the weather of 26 stock exchanges. In the morning, what was the weather? And they found that if in the morning, around the opening hours, it was sunny, the daily stock return that day was significantly higher than the rest of the year. Now, you have to ask yourself, to what degree weather should be correlated with stock returns? So I think they had a case to associate this observation as behavioral. You just got excited, and sunny day, when you trade, you tend to buy. Okay, so this is not exactly related to, you know, the alternative risk premium, but this is one of the first I found that it was quite clear that there were some behavior. The second one is recently John Cochrane, a professor at U of Chicago, and he wrote blogs, and it's very interesting. This is one of my bookmarks that I read his blog, and he recently made some comments on behavioral finance, and in particular on value premium. Everyone thinks the other guy is behavioral. Are you sure it's not you? Okay. So the question is, we have observed these value premium for decades, and you know there are behavioral science to explain why, but how come we continue to see it? It's just because we ignore or we encourage the fresh graduates to come into the industry and they trade and make the mistakes that we made 30 years ago and pay us, right? So maybe mistakes being innate, right? And you know, don't quote me, right? But I have read a lot from Mr. Warren Buffett, and he kept telling us that the market was inefficient. Well, it could be. It could have been inefficient, right? And it has been proved that the market cannot be exactly efficient. That's the result that we know. But if more and more of us believe in the market inefficiency, somehow we must be writing the check to pay for those who win, right? So there's one argument is maybe some of these behavioral mistakes are innate. They are born in us. So that is it. I'm not any expert on behavioral science at all, but indeed, like in here, I actually tell you exactly how I created this risk premium. But I'm going to use it as a motivation to discuss about what about compensation to risk. Now, if you look at how we have created alternative risk premium, it usually go by step. You identify a characteristic like book to price. You sort the stocks in descending order, and then you long and short. Now, suppose I am doing the following. I have a universe of assets, and I rank by characteristics. I go long and short. So by step, I don't violate any rule, right? I'm just trying to backtest a alternative risk premium. But now I have disclosed to you the characteristic that I use to sort these is based on the security identifiers. For those of us who have played with these securities database, there's usually an identifier. Is it common stock, preferred stock, ADR, etc., right? So I'm just expanding my universe to include bonds as well, and my identifier is the security. If it is stocks, I long. If it is bonds, I short. Now, having disclosed to you Now, clearly, you can see what I created in here is what we call the equity risk premium, right? Everybody knows this is equity risk premium. I long stocks and short bonds, but again, step by step, I'm just following the typical, right? So I created this risk premium, and this is the calendar year return. It is very legitimate. Okay, it looks fine, but now the question is the following two. First of all, are you concerned that this risk premium will be arbitraged away? Right? This is equity risk premium. Okay, my answer is no, because I am convinced this is a real risk premium. I can choose not to have it, but even if I try, I cannot arbitrage it away because it is systematic, it will stay. So the second question is now talking about smart beta. I hate the name, as a matter of fact, smart beta, as if you don't do it, you are not smart, right? Think about this risk premium. I wonder any one of you is focusing on fixed income. Okay, so imagine when I talk to my clients, well, don't you know there is an equity risk premium? And why are you investing in fixed income? There is a smart beta out there. There is a smart alternative risk premium out there. Why don't you get more of it? It just doesn't make sense. So I'm using this example. Of course, I'm stretching because everybody knows I cheat. This is equity risk premium. But had I not told you how I sought the securities, you would not have figured it out, right? But in this case, right, the fact that there exists a risk premium, it doesn't mean that every one of us should expose to it, should have it, okay? So if this risk premium doesn't solve my investment problems, as a matter of fact, some of us may be better to be a provider of this risk premium. And you may as well just stay with fixed income and have zero exposure to this equity risk premium. So I want to make the case that smart beta doesn't mean that investing in it is smarter, and likewise, alternative risk premium, it doesn't mean that having identified them, you must have it. And I'm going to make some points in the next few slides. Some of us should be the provider of this risk premium. And as a matter of fact, many of these alternative risk premium have net zero supply. Okay, for every one of us who receive a risk premium, you have to identify some other investors who write you a check. And there should be reasons why some of us choose to be on the other side of the trade. Okay, so look at this. I just quote this article. In fact, this article was circulated more than 4 years ago and only published in the last month in the Journal of Finance. Is these authors did a very thorough job. Is they look at 97 variables published in the academic literature, and the way that they defined when the factor was made public was based on the dates that they started to see the paper circulated in working paper stage. Because normally it takes about 3 years to get a paper published. It's very tiring. Yeah. So they tried to date that more precisely, and they found that about 26% of the identifiable return in the back test was gone post publications. And about 32% was gone because of publication informed trading. Okay? So roughly, you may interpret this as there's a data mining about 25%. Okay, this post-publication, the return dropped 26% means roughly about a quarter of that reported return in literature or in backtest may be the result of data mining. And then post-publication, 30% more of the return was gone. So net-net about half, slightly more than half of the historical return could have been gone post-publication. Now, there are more interesting things in this quote. Is post-publication declines are greater, etc., etc., etc. And the last sentence, predictor portfolios exhibit post-publication increases in correlation with other published predictor portfolios. Now, what does that mean? Suppose you have value premium, size premium, and now 1992 Jagadish and Tidman published a paper, Momentum. What this last sentence means is somehow after the momentum factor was published, the correlation of stocks that we try to buy or sell in momentum became more correlated with the factors of value and size as well. That's what it means. Now, what does that imply? It probably implies, as we are learning from this academic literature, As soon as we got convinced about a new factor, a new risk premium was born or identified, we put it into our own portfolio. And when you trade all the factors together, right? So you create these correlations among the factors. So I thought this is really like pretty eye-opening for us to think about crowding. Okay. Now, more into the topic of crowding. Now, this, bear with me, this is somewhat relevant to the discussion of crowding as well. What you are looking at on this page is, I took this from the Nomura report when Joe Mesridge, about 3 years ago, he came to my office and presented these charts to my team. And each one of these is showing us the average intra-sector pairwise correlation of stocks in the US, in Japan, in Europe, and in Asia. Okay, so these are average intra-sector pairwise correlations over time. And ignore the red line for the time being. Okay, the blue line is the correlations. Now, what do you notice in here? Somehow, in three of the four regions, right, in US, Japan, and Europe, somehow around after 1999, you started to see an uptrend in the correlations. Now, I don't think we need a data mining to see that, right? Somehow it was going up. And at the time, Joe was sharing, like questioning, like, why? What caused this higher correlations? And on the spot, I gave him my answer. For the first time I saw this chart, it reminded me something. In 1999, when I was working on the individual equity, in 2001, when I was working on the individual equity database, I had to look at the academic literature in order to do industry classification. We were using like Gene Farmer's appendix in his papers, the SIC code. But as the gigs of MSCI and S&P started to become more like the standard, suddenly I got, okay, well, I'm going to outsource it to MSCI gigs. And from that point, I no longer do my industry classification anymore. And I think by now, the gigs has become one of the standard, right? If not the most followed standard of sector classification. What does that mean to us when there is a standard of clustering? When we trade sectors, now we don't do our homework and trade all the names as classified by the gigs. And that's my explanation why after 1999, that was roughly when gigs was launched, we started to see these correlations going up. And there was another set of articles published in the academic journals. They look at the index constituents. When a particular stock was introduced into an index, they saw two things. A sudden jump in correlation of this stock with respect to the other constituents, as well as a permanent increase in its returns. So clustering actually creates correlations, and we have seen this in sector classifications. Now, how can we use this experience to extrapolate to alternative risk premium? And this page is taken from a paper I published 2 years ago that I make a forecast. I don't know about their returns going forward, okay? It's everyone's question. But what I focus is on the impact of more and more of us got convinced about their existence and we started to trade. And by trading, it doesn't have to be all of us are buying it. As long as when I want to buy, someone was selling me, right? And as long as we have some overlap in this definition of risk premium, whether value, you use book to price, earnings to price, cash flow to price, etc., there must be some overlap in the definitions. As long as there are more trading, I predicted that my forward-looking Sharpe ratios of these premium will go lower. And here is my logic. Okay. So the volatility of my risk premium has two legs, right? One is the long leg, the L. One is the short leg. And then because it's long and short, then you have the minus 2 times the covariance, right? This is definition of volatility of my long-short risk premium. Now, if you think about the clustering, now when you trade, when you buy the value premium, you buy all the stocks that are ranked high, you short all the stocks that are ranked low. And likewise, when I sell the value risk premium to you, I do the opposite trade. But by trading the long legs, the names in the long legs together, we created a correlation and make the long leg a less diversified portfolio. The stocks that are ranked high by book to price become more correlated. Likewise, the same happens in the short leg. So then you have a bigger sigma L, you have a bigger sigma S, and then even worse, when you buy the long and sell the short, or the counterparty sell the long and buy the short, you create a higher magnitude of the rho LS. So overall, by trading against each other, we create a higher volatility of this risk premium. The sigma should go higher. Now, I don't know about returns, but unless the active, unless the future risk premium goes higher, which we don't know, but just by the fact that we create a higher sigma for it, the expected Sharpe ratio should go lower. And if it's expected Sharpe ratio to go lower when you optimize, naturally you will allocate less to this risk premium. So that's the, I think, foreseeable future for some of these alternative risk premium, is they will naturally become a lower Sharpe ratio type of premium. Now, will it go to zero? My wishful thinking is no, because I am convinced that these are risk premium. They cannot go to zero. But I can expect that the Sharpe ratio can go lower. And again, it doesn't have to be every one of us want to buy. As long as some of us buy, some of us sell, you will create an environment that the Sharpe ratio will go marginally lower. Okay, now I have been sharing about the concerns about crowding. Now let me try to ease the concern a bit. Some argue that you can look at the valuation spread. And in here, I just plot the valuation spread as measured by book to price and sales to price of a particular value premium. This is not a standard value premium. This is one of our more like proprietary value premium. And just to make the case, over this long period of time from 1990 to 2016, okay, as of last month of 2016, there was no clear evidence that the valuation spread was compressed because of crowding. Okay, so it's subject to your interpretation. What does that mean? That means there's no crowding, you know, there may be some other reason. So valuation spread was not compressed. The next one, and this is a real example. Suppose I have all these factors in my security selection, and I have two value, four quality, and three momentum. And I rank two stocks, A, B, C, and X, Y, E, Z, according to each one of them. And as you can see, I represent the green bar as A, B, C, and red bar as X, Y, E, Z, and each one of them rank differently, right? So, now suppose there are two managers. The first manager assigns equal attention to all of these factors. Then, obviously, this manager will prefer the green. Stock A, B, C is naturally ranked a bit higher than average. And dislike the, maybe dislike the red in here, right? Because three of the criteria rank the red below average, only two above average. But suppose there is another manager using exactly the same criteria and rank the two stocks, but this manager has a quality bias. In other words, this manager focused on the column 3 to column 6. And now when you see the column 3 and column 6, red actually stands out. This quality bias manager actually prefers X, Y, E, Z. So this is, of course, a hypothetical example to show something very possible. If, even if we are using the same criteria to define risk premium, depends on how much weight you assign to each one of them, you can have a scenario that two different investors are trading the stocks, buying and selling, and they can be macro consistent. Okay, there's no reason to expect that every one of them should buy the green and the light. It comes down to the way that you define your final portfolio. And this is actually supported by a number of articles in here that I cited. And allow me to just highlight four of them. There are many others. Alternative risk premium are normally run by quants because you have to deal with a lot of assets and data, ranking, optimization, risk management, etc. And there's one of my favorite articles, which was actually a Bernstein survey, the Bernstein research done in January. It was published in January 2007. And if you may recall what happened in August 2007, some call it the quant tsunami. This survey was done a year before the quant tsunami. Okay, that's important. What they found was when they surveyed 21 quant equity managers, and all of them had sizable assets, and asked them to submit a few things. The ranking of stocks, your positions, descriptions of your process, and the definition of factors. It turns out that the survey found that vastly different rankings and performance despite similarity in factor exposure. So this is one data point, one observation. Again, that was done before the Quan tsunami that people call it, that's quan crowding. The second paper is in 2010, and it's published in Journal of Investing, in which they use a return-based approach and run analysis on the returns of the quant manager, and they draw the same conclusion, the quantitative manager, and that these differences can be significant. This one, the third one, is done by LSV, right? And they use the investment database and look at the correlations of quant managers versus correlation of fundamental managers, and they concluded that there is as much heterogeneity among quantitative managers as there is among fundamental managers. So lastly is a Russell, the consultant Russell, who did a more or less similar study, and they draw the same conclusion. We find low correlations providing support for including multiple quantitative managers' investment structures. Okay, so somewhat I feel like the quant crowding may have been overstated. It is a fair concern, but it seems like it is not as serious as we used to worry about. So all these I try to present a more balanced view. Okay, I think crowding is a fair concern, but let's look at the evidence as well. And again, there are multiple measures proposed already. Now, I'm going to keep you for 5 minutes more and talk about now. Suppose we are convinced about these alternative risk premia. How do we think about how much? Okay, when you think about traditional risk premia, 60-40, 65-35, you run your strategic asset allocation analysis. But now, how about there is a new breed called alternative risk premia? And I just put down some consideration in here, and let me just skip this slide and go to the next to last. How much alternative risk premia? And I put down a few considerations in here. One is, well, of course, your objective and risk appetite. Second, to me, is important is career risk. Okay, and I'm going to elaborate further what I mean by career risk. And the third is constraints, leverage. Alternative risk premium require leverage, and sometimes it can be pretty high, 5 to 10 times, and it also requires shorts. Okay, if the clients does not allow these, then forget it. We cannot run alternative risk premium. We can only run smart beta. And you can see those like distortions in the positions. Completion portfolios versus ARP allocation. What it means is some of my clients are interested to selectively include a few of these alternative risk premium, maybe because they already think we already got enough value and I don't need the whole package. Can you just give me everything excluding value, for example? That's completion. Versus if you just allocate as if it was a standalone strategy, you could just allocate to what we call the ARP, alternative risk premium. And tracking error. Now, tracking error, I suppose, like, you don't need me to define it, but in here, I think the tracking error also reflects career risk as well. From my experience with my clients, for those who do not allow shorts nor leverage, to take 2% tracking error is already very, very difficult. Believe it or not, 2% tracking error is very high in the whole plan. From time to time, we struggle to push it to 2% tracking error. And so in the next slide, the last one that I'm going to show is to use tracking error as a measure of how different your portfolio can become as you increase your allocation to these risk premium. Okay. And when it becomes more and more different from the traditional portfolio, your career risk also goes up. And we have seen this before, alpha beta transfer, right? 10 years ago, 130-30, right? All these old days phrases, you know, they got kind of cold. So what I'm going to show you the last slide to give you some thoughts of how do we think about allocation is, it's very simple. You start with 100% traditional portfolio, and then you slowly add. You take away 10% from your traditional portfolio, put it in a 10% volatility, alternative risk premium, and look at how much tracking error, as well as how much volatility reductions. Now, in this example, I have some correlation assumptions, and for the time being, I just assume that the correlation of alternative risk premium with respect to traditional portfolio can be from plus 0.25 as conservative to zero to minus 0.25. Minus 0.25 probably is too good to be true. But you get the range, the sense of the range, what it means. If you look at the purple line in here, which is the volatility reduction, the case that the ARP is uncorrelated with traditional portfolio, with 10%, 20% allocation, you get a reduction of volatility by about 1%. So instead of 10% vol, your overall portfolio dropped to about 9%. So that's something good. But tracking error, if you allocate like 20% to the ARP, you are getting there. You will have around 2% tracking error, depending on what assumption of correlation you use. But when you push it to 30%, your tracking error reaches 4%. And I mean, to this date, I have not worked with the clients who could have a 4% tracking error. Like 2 is more like the standard. Beyond 2 will require leverage and will require a short as well. So my back of envelope suggestion is probably around 20% allocation to these alternative risk premium may be the right number for us to start to think about to the left less or to the right more. This is quite in a sharp contrast in another conference that I spoke. My peer actually did some analysis of optimization and their recommendation is you should allocate 70% to alternative risk premium. Now, I can see why, because if you look at the simulated returns of these alternative risk premium, their Sharpe ratio is much higher than traditional portfolio. But I like to start with a more conservative stance and think about to what extent your final portfolio will be different from your traditional. As it gets more and more different, you will have more and more explanations to give to your clients and board members as well. So I would like to start with about 20%. So I think in here, I'm just concluding my talk is, it's you know, like 1 hour, less than 1 hour, and this is a very broad and can be a very deep topic. And here, I'm really just scratching the surface. I'm not sure like, to what extent you find any one of these slides interesting, but suffice to say, this is one of my more passionate area because it allows us to really apply asset pricing theory to solve investment problems of our clients. And we are very flexible in terms of working with our clients, like whether it is the whole package or kind of customize it to make it a completion portfolio. At the end of the day, it is part of the investment solution. So I personally do not believe a one-size-fits-all strategy, but at least this gives us a reasonable starting point to think about where of the CAPM, the standard or traditional risk premium. Now, in parallel, within each of the asset class, if you recall that Rubik's Cube example, within each of the asset class, we can do something to rotate it in order to package some of these non-synchronized payoff into the whole package, and that can make the total package more interesting and more robust. So just to give you a final point is this is the area that I am getting the most interest in the last 6 months, whether it is from clients or from conference presentations as well. That's why I call it the Big Bang. It's really expanding in terms of number of product providers, number of factors, and also the client interest. So I'm going to just stop here for now, and you know we still have some time for networking, and if you have any questions, you will be more than welcome. Or we can just talk when we are in the networking time as well. Wow, I couldn't believe I talked non-stop for 1 hour and there was no questions. Okay, everybody got it. I think that reflects the background of the audience, right? Okay, then thank you very much, then.